this is Elaine Werner-Hudson, and we are on 1680AdviceRadio.com, and with me I have...
co-host Sarah Stuchel, licensed marriage and family therapist, and today we're going to present to you Project Josh, and this is Imagine, our radio show for Project Josh, which is a nonprofit foundation raising money to help teens and their families struggling with substance abuse and addiction issues.
We're really excited to be here and bring this show to you because Sarah and I are both very passionate about addiction, both with alcohol and substance abuse. We both work in the field, and we are out to specifically working with adolescents at this time. We also are having a new program that we're going to be introducing. And when I say program, it's a recovery type program within the website, projectjosh.com. Actually, the website I should give to you is www.projectjosh.org. You can look it up. It's got a lot of great information. It tells a story. I happen to be the mother of Josh. I'm a surviving mother of Josh, who lost my son. Is coming up on 4 years now, March 11th of 2007. Sadly, I'm in a club I don't really want to be in. Club of Losing Your Child is a club that no parent wants to be a part of. Every year is hard. This is a hard time for me with the anniversary coming up. It's a very difficult time. And so I think it's really a good time to begin our program Imagine, because my goal in my life for the rest of my life is to help others so that Josh's death is not in vain. And Sarah, would you like to tell a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I completed my master's in psychology from Pepperdine. I'm finishing a PhD at Loma Linda University. I've completed all my coursework, finishing my dissertation on women's substance abuse issues, specifically looking at how they impact their marriages and their family life. I've been working in substance abuse and addiction for several years. I've been licensed. I have a private practice in Malibu and Newport Beach. And this show is really important to me because there is so much misinformation out there on addiction and substance abuse. And this is a disease, but it's a completely preventable disease. And that is what Elaine and I are here to help families and teens understand and learn about causes of addiction, how it impacts your family life, what to do if you have a teen struggling with addiction, resources available, anything related to this topic. And we welcome calls from family, from teens, if you need advice or if you want to be a guest on our show. If you are a professional in the field and you want to come on and provide some of your expert advice in this area, we would welcome that. And you can call us at area code 562-945-2777. That's 562-945-2777. Today we're going to briefly introduce Project Josh, and then I'm going to interview Elaine about her son Josh, who she lost to heroin, a heroin overdose, and just get her story as a mother and what that was like for her and all the grief and the trauma that she experienced. So, Elaine, why don't you just briefly tell me or tell our audience a little bit about Project Josh and what it is. It's a nonprofit.
Project Josh is a nonprofit organization and developed it after the death of Josh to help. Originally, it was to help families who were not able to put their kids into recovery. Recovery these days is really expensive. I found that out when I was trying to seek recovery for Josh when I found out that he was using heroin. And at that time, I lived in Colorado, and it was about $30,000 up to get him into any kind of recovery. That's a lot of money for people who even have an average income to be able to come up with that kind of money. And so basically, that's what it originally came out to help people with that. And then basically after that, Sarah and I have been working on another program because we realized that recovery in itself, if you go to a recovery center, that it can be very effective as far as getting the person off of whatever their substance is that they're using, their drug of choice. But we also realized that 30, 60, 90 days is not enough. There's a lot of relapse that goes on. I believe that statistics show it's about 11% success rate, which is not very high. So we are also promoting our own program, which is going to be which is called Guardian Angel, and it's a program that is geared toward younger adults, age 15 to 25. And basically what it is a sober living program at which we, they're with us for a full year. We teach them how to go back out in society and live. These kids don't know how to have fun anymore. All they know is drug use. They've been using for such a long time. They do not know how to live their life. They get out of recovery and they say, now what's next? What do I do? They're lost, and most of them think that they can't have fun anymore because the euphoria that they have felt from whatever drug they're using is so much greater than any fun they could ever imagine having again. So when you look at that, it becomes a very complex situation, and also their cravings and their desires do not go away for quite a long while. So we're hoping to help these kids go out in the world and learn how to live in a social world, what their hobbies might be, what they want to do for work, anything at all that we can do. And another important part of this I'd like to bring up is that it also has to do with the parents. As Sarah was talking about addiction being a disease, it is a disease, yes, but it's a disease of the family. And that's one thing that I don't think a lot of families understand, Sarah. That's what I have found anyway talking to people, is that they believe that the addict is the one with the problem. And in fact, I can say from my own experience, it is a family disease.
Absolutely.
For myself particularly, I know that when I found out that Josh was using heroin, I was searching everywhere around the house looking for it. And it's not something that you can make someone stop doing. Unfortunately, I tried everything. I tried everything within the means of what I could to make it stop. But the reality is, until that addict is really wanting to stop, there's nothing that you can do.
Absolutely.
So with my story, I'd just like to tell you briefly a little bit about Josh. Josh was an amazing, charismatic, beautiful, sensitive, wonderful young man. Everyone loved Josh, particularly adults, because he was more adult-like with adults, where he would really interact with adults better than kids his own age. As he's growing up, he had fun like most kids do, but I noticed when he was very young, he had a lot of problems with anxiety. Found out when he was in grade school, I would be called into the counselor's office, and she said he's got a tremendous amount of anxiety. I had him go into therapists and whatnot, but this is something that I find interesting because as I deal with adolescents today, I find that's a very common problem that they experience from a very young age.
Yeah, I mean, in what we call dual diagnosis in the field, that means that there's not just the addiction or the substance abuse problem, but there's also a mental health problem that exists alongside. So there's two problems, dual. And most of the, I mean, there's a high prevalence rate of addiction and depression and trauma and things like that. And anxiety disorders is huge. It's probably, I think I read statistics around 80 or 90% of those who struggle with substance abuse and addiction also have an anxiety disorder. And that can range from anything like general anxiety to panic disorder to obsessive compulsive disorders. So it's a broad spectrum of small anxiety to massive anxiety. And people self-medicate that with drugs and alcohol. And unfortunately, you know, drugs and alcohol do tend to provide them temporary relief from anxiety. But the drugs also affect the brain chemistry in a way that when the drugs come out of their system, it also induces anxiety. So they're actually creating more anxiety for themselves, even though they experience temporary relief in the moment. So how did you see Josh? What were some of the signs? I mean, what did you notice about him that he was anxious? What did you see as a parent? Maybe you can help other parents spot anxiety with their kids. So what did you see about Josh?
One of the things I noted from the time that Josh was about 5 years old is he had some obsessive compulsive problems.
So what do you mean by that? What was he doing?
He was washing his hands. He was afraid of germs.
Okay.
Washing his hands so much that they became extremely chapped. Another thing is he had a ritual at bedtime where he had to have everything around his bed in a certain order. It was like a 2-hour job to get him to go to bed at night. Also, he had problems with a lot of stomach aches, more than common, but if he had any stress issues at all, he had bad stomach aches, and his greatest fear was vomiting. So that only increased the stress level that more and the anxiety that much more because he experienced that. So those were some of the biggest signs. And then when I was called into the counselor's office when he was in grade school, it was brought to my attention. And he also had a really hard time when he was a baby self-soothing himself. Like he wanted me to hold him all the time. I could not put him down and do other things. It was like I had to put him in a snuggly and have him next to me. So those were some of the first signs that I noted about Josh when he was younger.
So you said you took him to counselors and psychologists. Did they ever prescribe medication, or how did they teach you to help him with his anxiety at that age?
They did try to prescribe some medication, different antidepressants, and Josh saw on the little flyer that is inside the packaging that he had a 3% chance of vomiting, so he refused to take them. We also tried meditation, where he would go to a therapist that specialized in that and gave him meditation tapes. We used that. That helped a little bit, but that it didn't not enough to make any huge difference.
Were there any situations, say, in the home or in the social environment among his peers that could have been contributing to his anxiety?
One of the things that I think contributed to his anxiety was the fact that his biological dad was very abusive to him, and not just emotionally, but also very physically abusive to him. And I think that was a huge part of the problem. And I also was in a marriage where I was being abused as well. It was a family of abuse. And sadly, he grew up around that till he was 9 years old, and that's when I divorced. So I would say that a lot of the stress was probably around that, because it's not only the fact that he was getting abused, but he saw me being abused. And for a son to see their mother getting abused is one of the worst things in the world. It's something they never forget.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So now you have another son, Zach.
I do.
How old was he? Was he exposed to the abuse as well, or no, was he not born yet?
He was about 3.5 years old when I went through my divorce. And he was abused somewhat, but not like Josh, because he was more the invisible kid. I think Josh related better to his dad because he's more like his dad, so his dad could relate to him better. And Zach, when he was born, was very ill. So the first couple years, he had a lot of problems with lung issues. And I had to take care of him around the clock. So there was that going on as well, where I think that Josh might have felt a little bit pushed aside because he was the only kid for like 5.5 years, and then along comes his little brother. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I think there was that might have been an issue, because Josh and I were pretty much joined at the hip from the time he was young. We did all kinds of wonderful things. We'd go to the park. I'd pack him up on my bike, ride to the park every day, have lunch. We would read storybooks. This kid was the best reader I think I've ever seen. And I think it's just reading all the books I read to him when he was a kid. He just loved to be with me doing things. And we'd go to the playground and socialize with other kids, do play groups. I had him involved in gymnastics. I tried to do a lot of really normal things that a parent would do with their child when he was younger.
Now, did Josh ever talk out about being abused by his dad? Did he ever... did he have nightmares? Did he ever say, "Mom, what's going on?" Or did he act out? I mean, in addition to the anxiety you saw him experience, did he ever say anything? Or
he never would verbally say anything. I just knew that he had a lot of anxiety. And when I knew that something was going on, which I was there most of the time, I would intervene in the middle of it. And I actually have Josh kept a journal, and he would talk about how my mom would come and protect me and save me from my dad.
Wow.
So with that, it's also, that's a family disease to be in the midst of an abusive situation like that.
Yeah.
At the time, I realized that it was not a good, the right way for a family to be. I could acknowledge that. But I grew up in a very religious family, and the idea of divorce was something that was just not acceptable. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I tried to deal with it as best I can. However, I think it was very damaging, especially to Josh. Fortunately, Zach was much younger, so I don't think he had the damage that Josh did from it.
Yeah, I really commend you for talking about this, because stats show that many women do not leave relationships when there's domestic violence. It's very hard, you know, financially. It's hard to make it on your own. It's hard to think about finding someone new. So, share more about what finally drove you to that point to say enough is enough.
What actually happened is my ex-husband is the one who said that he wanted a divorce. And basically, it has gotten to the point in our relationship that he was having an affair, drinking. I did some pretty sick things, like when I knew he was drinking, I'd go to bars looking for him, which showed that one time I was pretty sick along with him. Because I got tired at night when I was waiting for him to come home from work, and I would have dinner ready. And I'd keep it in the oven for 2 hours and wait for him for dinner. And my kids and I would wait for 2 hours before we would be able to eat. And then finally I got to the point of being a little bit smarter, and we ate our dinner, and I kept the dinner in the oven for a while. Then finally I just said, dinner's this time, he's not home, because he would go out to bars. I really did not know what alcoholism was about back then.
You drink at all? Did you?
No, I did not. Socially, I drank a little bit, but not to any certain degree. I was not a drinker. But I did know that when I first met my ex, he was drinking, and we'd always go to parties. And every time we went to a party, he'd end up drunk. But back then, that was several years ago, it wasn't identified as alcoholism as it is today. So even though he was drinking and he was actively drinking, I did not look at it as alcoholism. And also the fact that I'm much more educated now than I was then. But, you know, back then it wasn't. Alcoholism is not what it is today.
Right. So when we say addiction is a family disease, yes, your husband drank, so there's some alcohol there, but you didn't. And I'm assuming you also didn't do drugs or anything.
I did not.
So it's more than just drugs being present in a parent or an extended family member. It's when we say addiction is a family disease, it's these pathological emotional systems or emotional ways of being in a family that contribute to the disease of addiction, because what happens is the emotional pain gets transmitted from generational family, and that's what people self-medicate. That's why kids self-medicate, that emotional pain, which is part of the family disease of addiction. So let's go back to Josh and when he first started self-medicating and when you first noticed he was using drugs and how he got into that and what he was using. And
okay. First of all, I just wanted to follow up with something you just talked about. The problem with Josh is he kept it inside, and I think his anger grew. And I think that that is part of his self-medication, because he just kept it. He wasn't able to get rid of all that anger at his father. And basically when he was in high school is when he first was put on a drug, Klonopin. Doctor did that because they thought it would help him with his anxiety, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was taking that drug fairly regularly, prescription drug. At that time, I don't think he was abusing it. I wasn't even aware of the fact of when Josh first used. I will tell you that after I found out he was using heroin, that I'd found out that he was age 17. He'd used LSD twice. Early 20s, he said he experienced cocaine. Problem with cocaine was that it is a stimulant, so it would make him feel more out of control of his anxiety. Mm-hmm. So his drug of choice were the opiates, and those are the downers, and those are the ones that would make him feel content and better. And he started out, I would say, when he's probably about 24, using those, like the opiates, hydrocodone, and other variations of those, just as a recreation drug, because he knew that if he felt a little bit stressed, a little bit unsafe and things of that nature, he could take that and it would help him calm him down. And that just started, I think, to be a progression, because I've actually found some of his journaling where he talks about that, where he started out and it was like that way it made him feel. He could be free. He could be free. He didn't have to worry about those stomach aches and the thought of vomiting, and the world was a good place. Mm-hmm. And he had moved out of my house when he was 17. So at this particular time, he wasn't living at home. Things seemed to be pretty normal for quite a long while. And then we started discovering Josh wasn't coming around. And particularly in about the year 2005 is when we noticed most of all. Zach, my younger son, which we brought up earlier, was diagnosed with cancer, an osteosarcoma cancer. It's a bone cancer. And that was in January 2005. And then in April of 2005, my husband was diagnosed with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. Josh was such a sensitive guy that he couldn't really come around. It just upset him. Him and his brother were extremely close. So I thought something might not be quite right then. There were a lot of red flags, but I could not put a finger on it. But as I look back, I see how that grew. And it grew to the point that Josh was consuming about 25 pills at one particular time every day.
Wow.
And able to get these online. Unfortunately, working with adolescents as I do, I realize how these drugs are out there. They're so accessible. I mean, you can get them anywhere. Facebook, you can get them on the street. You can talk to another person using. You can find any connection that you need.
In your parents' medicine cabinet.
Exactly. Parents' medicine cabinet. That's a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
And parents don't think of that because, you know, they may have a drug in there for anxiety or whatever for themselves that they just use when they need it. But that's the first place kids go,
mm-hmm.
is in the med cabinet. So that is a huge problem that I'm not sure that adults or parents are aware of as much as they need to be. That first of all those drugs need to be locked up away from your children because that it can be a place where they start. And they can start really young.
Absolutely. So how did you try and when you found out Josh was using heroin or any of the other ones. I mean, what did you try to do to help him? Did you confront him? Did you check him into a rehab?
What happened was I didn't even know he was using heroin until he got arrested for 6 felonies and put in jail.
Wow.
He was selling computers illegally on eBay, and he had 6 felonies against him. It's at that time I found out that he was a heroin user. I did not know he was using the oxys and the opiate drugs prior to that.
When you heard heroin, what went through you?
When I heard heroin, I had just read an article in the paper. My son had been publicized. This was huge. It was a federal offense that he'd been arrested for with these 6 felonies. Most parents would be ashamed and embarrassed that their kid was in the newspaper for that. I was on the phone instead with a dear friend crying and saying, I know I'm going to lose my kid from heroin. And Sarah, I knew nothing about heroin, okay? Josh had just said to me, educate yourself on heroin, learn about heroin. I knew nothing, but I knew enough to know that it kills you. And I had this feeling in my gut way back when he was in jail that he was going to die.
Wow. So did you get him into treatment?
I was trying to get Josh into treatment. During this time, I was taking care of my husband, Norm, who had ALS 24/7. He wasn't able to take care of himself anymore. It meant even going to the bathroom. He couldn't do anything for himself. He couldn't eat, nothing. So I had that going on. Zach had just gotten out of the hospital, pretty much finished up his chemo that he'd gone through for 9 months. And so therefore, I had that I was dealing with as well. I lived in Colorado at the time, and unfortunately in Colorado, there's not a whole lot of places that you can take your kid for treatment. I found 3 particular places and called them. It was like $30,000. There was one place that they can go for 72 hours, and they wouldn't even take him.
Wow.
So I was stuck. I was a mom stuck with knowing that a kid, my son was probably going to die from this drug, taking care of my husband. I made a few phone calls, found out it was going to be $30,000, trying to scramble and figure out how I was going to get $30,000 cash up front to put my kid into treatment.
Wow. Wow. Did Josh want treatment? Did he want to get off heroin and get better? Or was he beyond that point?
Sarah, sadly, I remember the day he passed away. It was a Sunday morning. He was getting ready to go to work. And I looked at him and I said, Josh, I'm going to get you into treatment. And he said, Mom, you're trying to ship me out of here. And I said, no, baby, I'm trying to save your life. And he said, Mom, you don't get it. I'm beyond help. There's no one that can help me. And I said, don't say that. There's always help out there. And he said, there is no one that can help me. I'm so beyond help. I look back, I realize now where Josh was. Josh was in a place. And if you go to www.projectjosh.org, you can read his letter on there. He was being tortured for many years with the oxys that he was on. He'd get up in the morning. All addicts do is live their day for that drug. I had no idea till I found this letter after he passed away, which was like a treasure for me to help me understand how a kid who was so dear and I was so attached to, who told me everything, could be using drugs. And after reading this, which I'd like everyone that's listening to please look that up under the website, it really, really is amazing, because he speaks directly about what the feelings were that he felt. And after reading that, I realized that he was being tortured. And I realized when he said, "Mom, there's nothing that anyone can do for me," that was from the bottom of his heart. He's being honest. Because he knew that he'd been using, and he knew that to get off that drug was next to impossible. Most people end up being institutionalized, in prison, or dead.
Wow. So, as a mother, what went through your body, your mind, when you heard him say that to you?
I started crying. I was pretty much out of control. And when he came out of jail, he moved back in with us and was with us for 89 days clean. It was really, truly about 2.5 months of the best time of my whole life. We had time alone with Josh, my husband, and Zach and I together, but we also had separate time. He spent a lot of time with all of us. And that's when I had my real Josh back. And it was amazing. I enjoyed that time so much with him. After the 89 days when he started using, that's when I really became really scared. And then, again, he went into the denial. I noticed one day he came up to me, and I could see a track mark on his arm. And he denied that he was using. And I said, "Josh, you have a track mark on your arm. You've just shot up." "No, no, Mom, I'm not using." It's a real craziness that you feel as a parent with these kids, because they'll look at you square in your eyes and you feel like you're almost crazy when you see for your own self that you actually see a mark that's left from their use.
I always tell parents, don't believe anything your kid says. Watch their behavior. Watch with your own eyes. Pay attention to what you see and what you feel, because they will lie to you point blank. And that's a sad thing, but it's the reality of this disease.
It is part of the disease. It is part of how they survive. They lie, they steal. That's why Josh did the eBay, where he was stealing what the deal was behind that is he was taking computers, fixing them up for people, but not delivering them. So that was like a federal offense. And sadly, that money was being used for drugs. Do I believe that Josh would have purposely done that had he not been using? Absolutely not. But it becomes a matter of life and death for them. They will do whatever they need to do to seek that drug, no matter what it takes and no matter at whose expense. And that's the other thing that took me a really hard time to understand, is how could my son, who loved me so dearly and I love so dearly, more than life itself, how could he have chosen heroin over me? How could he have chosen heroin over his brother? How could he have chosen heroin over his father? That was hard for me to understand. I now understand that you don't have that choice, that that drug becomes your world. It's like a demon in your body.
It possesses you.
It possesses you. And it took me a long time to understand that, because I grieved for 3 years after Josh passed away, thinking what I might be able to do differently. What could I have done to save his life beyond the possibility of treatment, which I was never able to get him into treatment? What could I do? And I'd like to go into that a little bit more. I'd like to take a break now, and we'll be back with and continue what maybe more I could have done to help Josh.
And we'll get into what it was like for you when you found him dead.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about
yes,
that.
Yes, I would like to explain what that was all about.
Thanks. You are listening live on AdviceRadio.com.
1680 AM.
Thank you. When people say you're bright, they mean you've got a lot going on up there. It's not something people who use drugs hear much, because over time, drugs can change their brain. And the more times they try drugs, the more they want them. It's called addiction, and it's a disease that will waste your brain. For information, visit StopDrugAddiction.org or call 1-800-729-6686.
Huh? You talking to me? All right. I'm supposed to tell you that, hello, I'm supposed to tell you that whenever I listen to AM 1680, I enjoy acting up with Skyler and Steve, although right now they're not acting up too much because I broke both their legs. Thank you.
Visit us online for show archives and more at actingupshow.com. Follow us at twitter.com/actingupshow.
Hi, everyone. This is Tony Aiello. Hey, recently my wife was involved in a car accident, and thankfully she was uninjured. But our 2006 Corolla wasn't. It was a wreck. I brought my car to Advance Auto Body in Santa Fe Springs to get it fixed. And let me tell you, they did a great job. My experience with them was quick, efficient, and their quality... Well, let's just say I couldn't even tell our car was involved in an accident. In a state-of-the-art facility, the team at Advance Auto Body are collision repair specialists, and they work with all the major insurance carriers. They're family-owned and operated, and they've been serving the La Mirada area since 1994. You can call 562-802-1215 or stop by and say hi to Francis and Jerry. They're located right up the street from Valley View Avenue at 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue. That's 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue in Santa Fe Springs. Advance Auto Body, 562-802-1215. That's 562-802-1215 for Advance Auto Body, your collision repair specialists.
Lifestyles, I'm Deborah Wetzel. Every bride wants to look beautiful on her wedding day, and achieving that perfect look is easy with some expert advice on the right beauty products. Kelly Kwan, celebrity makeup artist, says a little preparation can make the day go a lot smoother.
Being prepared is the key to pulling off a gorgeous look, so select products that can multitask. For example, choose a creamy lipstick that doubles as a blush, and use petroleum jelly, which adds shine to lips or can be dabbed on hair to prevent flyaways.
And since brides spend most of their big day smiling for the camera and guests, how should they keep their smile looking luminous?
Prior to the big day, get in the habit of brushing with a battery-operated toothbrush to remove surface stains and a paste that restores whiteness to teeth. These are also great tools to bring along for quick smile touch-ups in between the ceremony and reception. Also, be sure to choose lipstick colors that have a blue or cool undertone, like a mauve or pale rose. These will make a bride's beam look extra white through all her wedding day photos.
I'm Deborah Wetzel.
There is a way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute, but first... Believe it or not, there is a way to avoid the use of pesticides, insecticides, and all the other sides that are toxic to you and I. And it's really simple to do if you follow through properly. First off, start with healthy plants in and around your garden, as well as your house plants. A plant that is healthy will ward off any insect or disease. So that means you're going to need to stay on top of fertilizing and correctly watering your plants so that the immune system of the plant does not deteriorate, therefore encouraging this kind of activity. Another practice to keep on top of is deadheading spent flowers. Once a flower has provided the color and the beauty that it had to offer, you need to get rid of it. Clearing away fallen leaves and debris is another way to deny pests of a place to live. And finally, mechanical controls such as hand-picking and using barrier traps is a great way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute.
How to deal with someone who says that's so gay. Turn it around. Did your mom cut the crust off your peanut butter and jelly sandwich? That is so gay.
Oh yeah? How would you like it if I said that so guy who makes fun of other people's sandwiches mostly because he's secretly jealous of them and who also has ketchup on his face?
Okay, jeez. Sorry. Wait, do I seriously have ketchup on me? When you say that's so gay, do you realize what you say? Knock it off. Learn more at thinkbeforeyouspeak.com. Brought to you by Glisten and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Imagine Show on AdviceRadio.com. This is Sarah Stuchel, licensed marriage and family therapist, with my co-host, Elaine Werder-Hudson. I'm going to finish interviewing her and pick up where we left off about her experience losing her son to a heroin overdose. So, Elaine, let's get into that. So what was it like when you found him dead or when he overdosed and died?
I want to take you back a step further because 4 days before he died, he overdosed then.
Okay.
What happened is it was 2 o'clock in the morning. He came up and gave me a hug, good night. Very affectionate young man, he always was. And asked me if he could have a second hug. And I gave him a second hug. He seemed to be okay. I went to bed, and I'd been in bed 20 minutes, and Zach came upstairs pounding on the door and saying, Josh is dead. What had happened is Zach had come upstairs to make some nachos and noticed that his brother had been in the bathroom for quite some time. Walked by a couple times, thought, wonder what my brother's doing in the bathroom. Finally decided to knock on the door and didn't hear anything. He then proceeded to say, hey, bro, it's me. I don't know what's going on, but on the count of three, I'm coming in. He did his 1, 2, 3 and opened the door. The first thing that he saw was rubbing alcohol bottle open because he smelt it. Mm. His brother was laying in a fetal position on his side. And Zach went, grabbed the phone, dialed 911 before he even came upstairs. This, I said, is 20 minutes. I remember looking at the clock. It was 20 after 2 in the morning. My husband, who can no longer walk by himself, is begging me not to go downstairs because he doesn't want me to go down and find Josh. And I'm saying, I cannot allow Zach to be there by himself. I have to go downstairs. I went down to the bathroom. He was laying in a fetal position. He was purplish, bluish, looking like he was dying. I tried to wake him up. I tried to shake him gently. I tapped him on his face, and I couldn't wake him up. I noticed his respirations were very slow. In the meantime, I'm racing around panicky because I'm wanting the police and the paramedics to get there as soon as they can because my son's dying. I run outside. They pull up, and I'm yelling, get in the house as soon as you can. My son has just overdosed on heroin. Get in here. They came in, went downstairs, and I immediately went into shock. My whole body started shaking. That was how I reacted. Wow. I came into shock. It was a very noticeable shock. They were down there for maybe 5 minutes with him, and I could hear him talking. And I was praying during this time that he would be okay. We all heard his voice, meaning Norm, my husband, his brother Zach, and I. And what had happened is they had given him a shot of Narcan, which reverses the heroin, and asked him, what is your name? Who is the president? Anything to see whether or not he was able to comprehend what they were talking to him about. He knew everything. He knew his name. He knew who the president was. They then took him in the ambulance to the hospital. Now, this is a problem that I have that I'd like to bring up right now. We arrived at the hospital. When we walked in, Josh's response was quite surprising to me. He looked at us, he said, hi, Mom, hi, Dad, hi, bro, like nothing had even happened, number one. Number two, the medical industry has got to get educated on addiction. When I walked into that hospital and saw my son in that bed, he looked perfectly fine, yes, okay. Supposedly, not that much time had passed, but they had a person come in and talk to him about where he was psychologically at that time. They had a mental health person, I guess, all the time there, just in case things like this happen. So I asked them about keeping Josh at the hospital because I knew that he's an addict. He's just going to overdose again. The nurse told me that they had had a mental health person come in and speak to him and that he was totally fine to go home. This makes me angry because the nurse literally looked at Josh and said, Josh, all you need to do is go home and take your balloons of heroin and flush them down the toilet. And I looked at her and I said, you don't get addiction. Addicts do not flush their drug of choice down the toilet. They use it.
Not only that, but they will lie to the mental health specialist or nurse at the hospital to get out of there and go shoot up again immediately.
Absolutely. And that's why I asked to speak to the mental health person. They said, he's already gone home. You can't, and you've got to get out of the hospital. So we were kicked out of the hospital. So sadly, was 4 days later. Zach and I, in the meantime, had been looking all over the bathroom, all over the house for balloons of heroin. Because we were going to try to find those. Because we wanted to save his life. You know, we were a close family. He was a huge part of our lives. We loved him and he loved us. I realized, Sarah, that that's something I have no control over. I can't find his heroin. I don't know where he's hiding his heroin. If I find it, he's going to get more. He's an addict. He needs help. That day on Sunday before he went to work, which I brought up before, we talked a little bit about earlier in the program when he was going to work, and I told him I wanted to get him into treatment. He said there's no one that could help me. I decided that evening to go to an Al-Anon meeting. There was only one person at that Al-Anon meeting, which is kind of interesting. Al-Anon meetings, you're not supposed to have any crosstalk. It's supposed to be where you express yourself and everyone expresses themselves. However, at this meeting, I had pretty much come to a conclusion that either I was going to go crazy over losing my son, or I was going to lose my son, or maybe he would be okay. I didn't know. But I knew that I had no power to help him outside the possibility of getting him into treatment. That was the only thing I possibly could do, which my time was running out. So basically, sadly, I guess I should say, it was 4 days later that a Sunday, and I went to the Al-Anon program and left there saying I was going to give this to God. And I meant it from my heart. I had come to that realization because I was starting to become crazy myself. I was getting very sick with him. Came home. Josh still wasn't there. He came home from work, came upstairs, and looked at me in the hall. And I'll never forget the look he had in his eyes. It was a very soulful look where he looked directly eye contact that was so deep that it was like it went to my soul and my eyes went to his soul through his eyes. I'll never forget that. That was the last time I saw him alive.
Did he say anything or just the look?
He asked me if the protein bars that we have at the house, if they ever make me have to go to the bathroom. He always had constipation problems. So that was him letting me know that he was going down to use the bathroom. Did I think he was going down to use the bathroom because of constipation problems? I have to tell you, Sarah, no. You know, I really thought in my mind, he's going down to use. He's gotten off work, he's going down to use. But I'd made a promise to God that day, knowing that there's nothing I could do. In the meantime, he had promised his dad, Norm, who is, by the way, I want to just bring this up. This is my second marriage, which I don't think I brought up before. And Norm was the father to Josh and Zach, and a wonderful man who I honored, who has courage. He's my hero for surviving the disease of Lou Gehrig's. For anyone out there who is ever familiar with it, it's the most horrific disease, I think, on this earth. And he kept his sense of humor and his dignity to the end. And he, to this day, is my hero for that. And he was a father to my boys, the best father anyone could ever have. He was always there. Josh was going to come back, he told his dad, to have a cigarette with him. And 10 minutes had passed, and he didn't come back out. I, in the meantime, had gone out to my workroom to work. And I looked outside and saw Norm sitting out on the park bench and went over and said, come out to the garage with me. Another 10 minutes passed, and I said, I can't take this anymore. Because in my gut, I knew something was happening. I went into the house, and Norm said, take a phone and do not open that bathroom door. Now, this bathroom door downstairs did not open or did not lock, so it was very easy to get into it. So I promised him before I left, I said, I won't open the door. He said, take the phone with you. I knocked on the door, and it was like an eerie silence around me. It's like so silent that I knew in my heart. Almost felt like the sound of deathness. I can't even explain what that was like. I immediately became quite hysterical because, of course, I'm thinking my son's in there, possibly dead. On the phone with 911, don't even remember much about the call. Just remember that I was hysterical and she's trying to keep me under control. Within about 5 to 10 minutes, we had help at the house. They'd actually sent the SWAT team over because they didn't know he was in the bathroom. They didn't know if he might have a weapon. It's just, you know,
wow,
general, I think, backup of what they do in a situation like that. And the SWAT member told me he was going to go downstairs and break the bathroom door down. I said, you don't have to break the bathroom door down. You can just open it. I'm standing in the stairway outside the bathroom, and he says, quick, paramedics, get here. I hear a faint pulse. I feel a faint pulse. Afterwards, I find out that Josh is laying over the toilet, and they feel a faint pulse. But before I can even go upstairs, they have taken him out of the bathroom by pulling him by his ankles. And this all happened so fast. It was crazy. I couldn't even get up the stairs fast enough. And I see the color of his body. And I can tell by the color of his body that he's dead. Okay. He was purplish, bluish. They're ripping the buttons of his shirt open to try to help him. You know, they're giving him mouth to mouth. They're giving him the shock treatments. In the meantime, we're upstairs for a good 45 minutes. I don't know. How would I even know how much time? I just know it's a long, long time. And they're working really hard to save him. And the next thing I know is they're trying to bring the gurney out of the house. And they're telling me that I need to go over to the policeman and turn my back. Because the way that our house was, it was an old house. It could only get out through the door by where I was. So they took him to the hospital. And I kept saying, is he doing okay? Is he doing okay? And they said, we're still working on him. In the meantime, Zach is at work. And the police are saying, we need Zach to drive home. And I'm saying, there is no way that I am calling him at work and telling him that his brother has overdosed. You need to go over there and pick him up. At this time, I pretty much know what's going on, but I still have a little bit of hope. While I'm in the house getting ready, Zach has arrived back home with the police, and it comes through on the radio that Josh has passed away.
On the radio?
On the
police
radio. And so Zach and Norm hear that. I did not. So I still have the hopes till I get to the hospital. And when I get to the hospital, I'm met with the advocacy program where they take you in and they're waiting for you to give you the news. I had called a dear friend of mine who was there. She actually used to be my therapist. She made it there before I did. And when I walked in, everyone was very somber, and I said, is Josh okay? And she looked at me and said, Josh has passed away.
Wow.
Zach said that the expression that I had on my face at that time, he will never forget, the look of my anguish in my eyes. I was asked whether or not I wanted to see Josh. I couldn't see him because I didn't want to see him in that black and blue purple state. I said, I can't handle it right now. I was so out of it. I don't remember much around that. I will tell you this, something that was pretty amazing is that it took me 8 days to get Josh out of the morgue. It took me 8 days to get out of bed to do anything. He laid in a morgue for 8 days because I didn't know what to do. That's how much shock I was in.
Wow.
And finally, when I decided that something needed to be done, it was because I wanted to go see him. I went to the hospital because I finally decided I wanted to see him. And they said, you don't see dead bodies in the morgue. You have to get a mortician. You've got to get a funeral service here to pick up his body. And then you can see him. And that's when I understood that I need to make funeral arrangements. That's, Sarah, that's how hard it hit me, as I was so non-functional. I couldn't even think. It was like I couldn't even put one foot in front of the other.
What pulled you out of that shock state or that numbness?
The numbness went on for a really long time. When I decided to go see him, was all of a sudden it became not a reality, but was like, I really want to see him. It was almost like the curiosity of like, God, is this a dream or is it really real?
Tell us about reading the coroner report.
I actually asked for a copy. This is not something that they generally give you. This was something I wanted, and I'm not sure it was a really good idea that I asked for this. I wanted to know everything. After something like this happens in a home, they have to do an autopsy. That is just recommendation, or not recommendation, it is just the law that they have to do an autopsy when there's a death in a home. And so there was no choice as to whether or not we wanted an autopsy. An autopsy was done. And during that time, I also needed to speak with the people at the funeral home and I can't remember the name of the person that takes the coroner. I'm sorry, coroner. This is still quite upsetting for me, so it's hard sometimes for me to talk about this. The coroner needed to talk to me, and I spoke probably a good couple hours on the phone because there was a question as to whether or not this was an accidental overdose or an overdose. We were also interviewed by the police. This was a crime scene. I had to walk through this, and I had to talk about it. And the coroner in particular, I spent a couple hours on the phone with him and told him that Josh had kept a journal where he had written things for ever since he'd been out of jail. He journaled for a good part of his life, but there was a lot of journaling he had done. And at that time, it's just like I wanted to know everything. I was trying to figure out how this could happen. It's like that is why I asked for the coroner report. I was going through my mind, going through the journal, going through everything I possibly could to put all these puzzle pieces together. But when I asked the coroner for a report, he said, we normally don't do this, but you have a right to it. It was sent to me. I remember reading that report. Probably got it about 3 months after Josh passed away. And I found out that really his body was just fine. His kidneys, his liver, every part of his body was fine, his heart. He died of an overdose, what they said was an accidental overdose, where it shut down his respiratory system.
So all of his organs were completely healthy?
All of his organs were completely healthy, even though he'd been using drugs very heavily for 2 years plus.
So what was that like for you to see that he was a healthy 27-year-old?
He was a healthy, vibrant 27-year-old with a wonderful personality that everybody loved. There's no one that didn't love Josh. It broke my heart because, you know what, I think this world missed out on a really special human being. I think he had a lot to give this world. His dream used to be, at one time, to work with kids that were abused, interestingly enough.
Well, he's left that legacy now with Project Josh. I mean, we're picking this up for him.
Actually, sir, I was just going to say, when he moved back in with me, he said, I've changed my mind. I want to work with addicts because I think God put me through this so that I could do that. So, yes, we are carrying on Josh's legacy today.
That is such a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story because God has taken me to so many places I never thought I could be. What I'm giving back, I'm getting back tenfold. But again, I'm passionate and just as you are about this. And we want to be there to educate and help other people with their children, other parents going through this. I'll tell you, it would have meant so much to me if I would have had the ability to speak to other parents to help me, support me, and to let me know I wasn't the only one going through this. And also for the teenagers to know they're not the only one going through it.
And it's important for parents to really get that just because your teen or young adult overdoses does not mean this is over. It's not a wake-up call to them, you know, and chances are they're going to use you. He used within, what, 4 days of overdosing the first time?
He did.
And that's what killed him?
Yes.
And that's scary, but that's the reality. And I know we only have probably about 5 or 6 minutes left here. So how should we wrap this segment up today?
Well, I would just like to say that I'm happy to be here today with you on a radio show. I'm hoping we'll reach a lot of people, and because we both have a lot of passion to help these young people and their parents. And I'd like to encourage everyone to please go to www.projectjosh.org. Look at the website. It's still, so things are being added to it, but I'd love for you to familiarize yourself with it. We want it to be a good resource for any parent or teen. There's going to be a lot of exciting things going on. And then also, I thought, Sarah, we might want to mention next week, we've got planned for next week.
Yeah, next week I'm going to have a special guest on. He's 19 years old. He just survived a massive heroin overdose, but he's a polysubstance abuser, which means he uses very heavily marijuana, opiates, stimulants, ecstasy, you know, all kinds of drugs. But he has massive brain damage from this overdose and from his drugs. So even though Josh was a healthy 27-year-old, we're going to present to you a 19-year-old with massive brain damage, massive physical damage, that's going to be very important for kids to see and for parents to see how drugs actually destroy the human body. And we're going to he's going to talk about surviving this overdose. He lost his hearing. He lost all the nerves in his left arm. He lost some of his cognitive functions, his memory ability. We're going to put his brain scans on the website so people can take a look at the physical pictures of what a damaged brain looks like. He was on dialysis. He lost kidney function for 2 months or however long. And he finally got his kidneys back working. So drugs, you know, are very dangerous. And he's very lucky to be alive. And he wants to come on the show and share his story. And that's going to be very exciting. You're not going to want to miss that.
Oh, that's amazing. We are so lucky to have him. And I'm sure he's a dear soul. Most of them are. Sensitive, dear soul.
And the other thing I want to say is, you know, it's Project Josh is brand new. You know, we just filed for our 501c3 nonprofit status. We have a link on there to donate. We're trying to raise money so that we can have an educational show like this on the air, so that we can provide services for teens in recovery and young adults, our Sober Companion Guardian Angel program, which we'll probably talk about in more depth in a later show. But it's very important. I mean, even if you can just donate $5, that would help, because substance abuse treatment is expensive. You know, it is $30,000 for a 30-day treatment program, which doesn't even guarantee that your teen is going to be clean and sober after going through that. It's a devastating disease, and we want to raise as much money as we can to help families in need.
I also would say that we're also here for any teenagers.
Yeah.
Any teenagers that need any help at all, that maybe are afraid to talk to a counselor or their parents, who are afraid to that want help but are afraid to ask for the help. We are here. You don't even have to use your real name. You can call. We can give you email addresses as well. The email address is survivingmother@projectjosh.org. That's again, survivingmother@projectjosh.org. You can email us. We will take phone calls next week. If there's anyone that would like to call in next week or have any questions, email us. We will touch upon those questions next week.
And again, the call-in number for next week is area code 562-945-2777. We are on www.adviceradio.com. Check it out. You can listen to our podcast at any time, share it with other people, pass it along.
That's 1680 AM. Thanks for listening to our program today. We hope you'll tune in next week. We promise it's one you shouldn't miss. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
It's easy to take your world for granted. Most days go by without a whole lot of surprises. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if everything familiar becomes anything but? Would you be prepared? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.